Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Hi, good morning, and a big welcome here to this next hour of what I think and hope you will all find to be a really remarkable story about Tom Hartdyke, who in the year 2000 was held hostage in Colombia, Panama, on the border, never quite sure which country he was in, for 9 months. He obviously got out, lived to tell the tale, wrote a book about it. But when he came back to Colombia on Wednesday evening this week, this was the first time that he'd set foot in this country since that happened. And the first place he went to was, we went up to Medellin, where we had a green festival, an environment festival of hay, which was connected to the wonderful green projects that they're doing in Medellin at the moment. But going to Medellin meant something very, very particular for Tom, and I'd like you to start off by just telling us why Medellin meant so much to you.
Buenos días a ustedes.
He speaks pretty good Spanish, by the way.
Yesterday, Rosie, going to Medellin to El Jardín Botánico was very special for me because 14 years ago, on April the 30th, yeah, nearly 14 years ago, one of the Colombian guerrillas that I was with, the boss, El Jefe, he said to me, Tomás, ¿por qué usted está viajando para buscar las orquídeas en el Darién? Cuando usted puede ver el Jardín Botánico en Medellín, solo $5 para entrar. No puedo olvidar este tiempo. Hace, 14 años adelante, ayer con Rosie, finally I go to Botanical Gardens in Medellín. Very big day. Con lagrimas.
Did they live up to your expectation?
They were fantastic, Rosie. The amount of orchids that were there, it was extraordinary. And there's no charge to go in.
Okay, I have to make it clear now that Tom is an obsessive. He is an orchid obsessive. He belongs to a great English tradition of orchid hunters, plant thieves, people who made tulips worth £20 million back in Holland and orchids up to several thousand. Tom grew up in a castle with a grandmother who loved gardening, and she made him from an age of a very small boy into an orchid obsessive. That's fair enough, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So when you left college, you set out to look for orchids all over the world, didn't you?
At the age of 21, I went to a whole year to spend in Southeast Asia, going to Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, seeing orchids in the wild, also collecting seeds of certain plants in the wild to bring back to our home at Lullingston in Southeast England, just south of London, and a whole year in Australia followed, so a whole 2 years away of seeing plants in the wild. I had grants from Kew Gardens, from the Royal Horticultural Society.
Sorry, yes, what? Oh. Okay, can anyone help with this?
It's okay? Okay.
Okay, so you're in Australia.
In Australia, a whole year in Australia, collecting plants in seed form, especially eucalyptus, lots in Colombia of eucalyptus. And then this magnetic draw, Rosie, this impulse of me to go to an area on the Panamanian-Colombian border to look for one of the best places in the world, Panama, Colombia, to look for the biggest family of flowering plants in the world, the orchid.
And this is the place called the Darién Gap.
El Darién, yeah.
So you turn up in where? In Guatemala to start with?
From Mexico to Guatemala, through Nicaragua, Costa Rica and Panama.
And you meet a fellow traveller?
I met a fellow traveller called Paul Winder from just up where I live in England, in Chelmsford in Essex, in southeast England. Amazing guy. He's a mountaineer at heart, not so much of a plant obsessive like me. An amazing guy. And we met in Mexico at the end of 1999, and beginning of March of the year 2000, we agreed to meet again together in Panama City to cross El Darién, and it's the only break in the Pan-American Highway for 17,500 miles from Alaska all the way down Panama, Colombia, to Tierra del Fuego in Argentina and Chile. A continuous strip of asphalt, except for this area, the Darién Gap.
So there were a lot of people, though, who said, don't go there.
There were lots of people, and in the year 2000, apparently, was not a good year on the Panamanian-Colombian border. Me and Paul Winder knew this. The local police were telling us not to go. But me and Paul, we knew this, but all I could think of was naming an orchid after my granny. Mi abuelita. An amazing person who inspired me at a young age in the world of plants, and wow. And that was the place to go and visit, to see orchids, and all the red flashing lights of danger turned bright green, and I could just hear and read. All I heard about the area was the rich botanical biodiversity for orchids. And Paul was more than mountains. He was fascinated by mountains, a mountaineer at heart. And he, that there are mountain ranges unnamed in the area, Rose. It's an unmapped region, even to this day, very poorly botanically understood.
You say in your book that you were both getting pretty nervous as departure day approached, and that if one of you had said, don't let's go, you probably would have turned back. Is that true?
Absolutely. It was two of us or nothing. And if the two of us were still agreeing to do it and we couldn't find two guides or one guide, we turned back. But we were both egging each other on. We really wanted to do it. And we found two amazing Colombian guides, Carlos and Francisco. Amazing people.
So what happened?
I'll never forget it. March the 14th and 15th, we were making amazing progress, and we were following a map in our Lonely Planet guidebook, 1995 edition. There's no maps of the area, so we were finding this extraordinary path through this rich UNESCO World Heritage Site, this biosphere. Orchids were just everywhere. It was the most extraordinary experience, and Carlos and Francisco, me and Paul, were having the best time of our life. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else in the world at that point on March the 14th and 15th, but there on March the 16th, anywhere but there. It was
you
the most...
were actually quite near the end, weren't you?
We were 2 or 3 days from crossing into the end, really. Apartador and Turbo. We were just a few minutes from there. Two or three days from there. We were still in Panama, 45 minutes from Colombia, when my life completely changed as these two figures just ran at us, first of all at Carlos and Francisco, and they just fell to the floor in combat gear, bandanas, big guns. And then me and Paul Winder just fell onto our hands and knees, hands behind our backs. These cool metal objects stuck to our heads. There were 3, 4, 5, 6 people then surrounding us. 3 girls, 15, 16, and 3 boys with all their guns. Our 2 Colombian guides dragged off into the woods, never saw them again, and marched back into the jungles where we had come. The stupid mistake me and Paul made of going there, we thought on that day, that's it.
So what happened in your first few days in captivity?
The first few days were really quite scary. We didn't know who they were. They didn't know who we were.
What did they tell you?
They told us that they were, when we did ask them, they told us that they were guards of the forest. They just were policing the forest. But they thought that we were CIA or drug runners. And I had to say to them, no, senor, soy jardinero. Soy jardinero. No, usted CIA. Usted CIA. No, senor, soy jardinero. Really quite scary. And the makeshift camps that we were staying at, they'd build the camps, Rosie, as we went from place to place, with a banana and heliconia roof, these little huts with 4 sticks joined up and then slatted across with banana and heliconia stems. And that's where we slept, with some 16, 17 people that were surrounding us in these first 2 weeks. Really difficult first 2 weeks.
How did you find the inner strength to cope with the beginning of your ordeal?
We just developed this. I'm just a gardener. Soy jardinero and polar mountaineer, but it's amazing how the mind just switches into this coping mechanism of just trying to survive, being polite. Ah, buenos dias, muchísimas gracias para el mono, el para el medio. All the food, thank them for the food. Look at the butterflies, I love the jungle. You miss your mum? No, I'll see her in a few years. That's not what you're thinking, that's not what you're feeling, but that's what you're saying to them.
But what, so your automatic reaction is to make yourself as human and as vulnerable and as lovable, so therefore they wouldn't want to kill you.
Exactly, exactly. And then to name them all these amazing, there are such extraordinary characters, and as a way of dealing with it, to humanize them, if you like, we named them selection of names. One chap in particular was just like the Hollywood actor Will Smith, but about 4 foot shorter. And Will Smith was a lovely man. He didn't want to be there. He didn't want to be doing this. An amazing guy. And it was a way of dealing with it, yeah, coping strategy. But that became more and more difficult as the months followed.
But what's clear from reading your book is that actually they don't really have a plan for you at all, is there? You move, you change, sometimes you move quickly. Did you ever ask them who they were?
We didn't really ask, we were reluctant to ask too many questions. They said that they were guarding the forest. Mm-hmm. We to this day don't know what particular group they were or who they were or what they wanted. And it was all so scary, so up and down, like this emotional roller coaster each day. You never knew what was going on, what they were going to say or do to you. But April the 30th, when the guy, maybe for Medellin, I don't know, the boss who told me about the botanical gardens, when he turned up for the first time in his pink tracksuit bottoms, revolver, grenades in his pockets, the tracksuit bottoms were coming down here, and he had this tea towel on his head with his eye had come out. He had these flies in his head. Unbelievable. We were inside the TV. It was a film, but it was actually happening to us. And he sat us down for 9 hours and interrogated us.
What kind of questions?
Usted CIA. No, soy jardinero. ¿Y por qué usted aquí? No, en Medellín, en a orchid fiesta there. Por $5. But here is where the orchids are. These are where new species are. And I went from tree to tree, grabbing these orchids and showing them Encyclia coschuliata, Lemberglossum, Odontoglossum cordatum, Stanopia costaricensis, Stanopia wardii, and so on. And he just, he didn't know what to say. He didn't know what to say.
You found a manual on the floor, didn't you, which said how to be a member of the FARC? Or?
They dropped this, Will Smith, out of the back of his rucksack, dropped this little manual, How to Be a FARC Member. And we opened up the index as his back was turned, and the last section was How to Treat a Hostage. So we were flicking through the back of the book, and Will Smith turned around to us, and we thought, we're going to die, that's it. And he went, oh, FARC manual, always dropping this. Picked it up and walked off.
That was... But they had... clearly expensive guns, yes?
They were very... What struck me in Paul, as we were in the middle of nowhere, was the amount of food they had access to, packeted food from Arroz to Panela, Tinto. It was amazing, the packets of food they had and the guns. They were so well armed. We were in the middle of nowhere, and during that whole time, Rosie, we saw about 500 different faces, from a six-month-year-old baby holding a grenade and pulling the pin out.
Gosh, that's, yeah.
To great-great-great-great-granddad, they called him, and he was about 34. He was the oldest chap there. So 13 to 18 would be a sort of average.
You kept your spirits up by designing gardens, didn't you? Every time you stopped, you tried to plant something. I mean, I remember your first one was literally just a creeper, and you started measuring it, yes?
As a way of dealing with the situation and to portray who I was, a gardener, not CIA, drug runner, and so on, I started to build these gardens during captivity. And I'm not recommending going to the Darien Gap and being kidnapped, but after being kidnapped, we saw some of the most extraordinary orchids. We were taken right up into the cloud forest. I forgot where I was. I forgot the seriousness of the situation. It was my heaven. It was extraordinary, 4,000 or 5,000 feet above sea level, the highest areas in El Darién, and the orchids were just dripping from the trees, air plants, bromeliad, and I started to build gardens with them. Mm-hmm. To start with, they went along with it, and Will Smith said, okay, you can have armed guards to go and collect your orchids. 4 or 5 hours walking sometimes to bring back orchids, and I'll start to build the garden where me and Paul were sleeping in our two-man tent. We slept for 9 months. But after 3 or 4 weeks of this, Will Smith said, we can't do this anymore. We hate you. We hate gardeners from England. We hate orchids. They didn't know what to do, so I'd show them what makes an orchid in the petal and sepal arrangement, in the female and male parts. And they just didn't know what to do. And they kept saying to me, you miss your mum a lot. Your mum is like a cochino. Sí, cochino, me gusta tocino. And they didn't know what to do. If I'd said, Rosie, oh, my mum, I miss her, and he misses his mum. No, I'll see my mum in 10 years. It's okay, I can stay here for a long time. They didn't know what to do.
It was a way of dealing with it.
But you had, I would say both the love of gardening and a kind of English eccentricity, as in only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun kind of line, that kept you going. How was Paul coping in all this?
Paul is more introvert, and that's why we get on so well. Me, the eccentricity, if you like, extrovert, and Paul, the introvert, and it balanced so well. Why we were there, it was an amazing relationship from a chap I'd only met a few weeks earlier. I didn't know his full name until we were kidnapped. I hardly knew him. And because of that relationship, he would get quite nervous with me sometimes about building the gardens. And, Tom, you're going to get a shot for these bloody flowers. You know, Tom, you've got to be careful in how you act and so on. But it was a way of me expressing myself. And our captors just didn't know what to do. But Paul was more introvert and kept things to himself, which during our time in captivity, Rosie, was great in the sense of he was so tough, like a steel door. But after being released, and to this day, finds it more difficult than I do because it's still in him, I think, a bit.
But Paul was the one who started to really think about escaping before you did.
He did. We were getting very frustrated 5, 6, 7 months into our captivity. Not really frustrated, actually, but really scared.
Yeah.
They'd had enough.
And they had said they wanted $5 million for you, and you'd said you hadn't got any money. But anyway, there was no means of communicating.
It was $5 million per head, so yeah, $10 million. And we knew that that was never going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And we think they just waited for 3/4 of a year. They said a helicopter's coming, and your parents will give $10 million. It will just appear in the woods. But we knew it wasn't going to come. Nobody was helping because there was no communication with anybody at all. So we thought, we're going to die. They're going to kill us. So Paul was stealing food off him. He was an amazing thief.
How did you nick the food?
He would have this, not mosquito net, like a mosquito handkerchief. You'd flap away the mosquitoes, everywhere the mosquitoes. And you'd go with a cloth, put it up, a bag of rice, and walk off for about 2 or 3 weeks stealing rice, lighters, machete. And they didn't seem to notice. And
where did you stash it?
We had our rucksacks, about this sort of size bag here, and we had a little bag, yeah, roughly that size each. It was like the top of the rucksack, which we took off, and we called them our escape pods, and we stored the food, machetes, in there. It was to prove very useful, but we never got a chance to escape.
Why?
Shivers down my spine talking about it, but we came within. Paul did. He was so keen. He was desperate. I was quite calm and okay, but he was desperate. And we came within 2 minutes of being shot. It was a guard change. We'd timed exactly when the guards were changing. When the rains came, our noise was muffled by the rain pouring down, tropical rain pouring down. And we thought, we're going to go now. And the guard change lasted about 15, 20 seconds. If we'd gone, we'd have hit the nearest tree. We couldn't see. You can't see in the jungle anything. We'd have run off and knocked over, and then probably would have shot us. But we just waited just a few extra seconds to see, and the guard changed. If we'd gone, well, I wouldn't be here today, I don't think.
Why didn't you try again the next day?
Paul was not very well. He had these worms in his leg and was finding it, the Chagas worms, 23 of them, and finding it very difficult to walk, and they were getting now into his leg, his nalgas, very difficult to walk, so he just began to sort of shut down, really, his body. He mentally was finding it very tough to get through, and he realised once that chance passed, his mind and physically as well was very difficult, so it was important I was there to keep his spirits up.
You had these horrible Chagas worms too. How did you get rid of them?
The Chagas worms are infected mosca, really, just a fly, and they just lay an egg in you. They go through clothes. They can't get through jeans or shoes, but amazing sting, and you feel the sting. No, it's just a fly, and their little egg inside. They go for the fat bits.
Yep.
And the egg's laid, and como topo, just like a mole, and they go into the bum and pulls. It was difficult to get them out. The only way the Colombians did it, and Panamanians, was amazing. They'd just, if the worm was here, bottom part of your leg here, they'd get just this syringe, fill it with anaesthetic, and they wouldn't just inject it slowly, they'd and sink the needle into the leg, and then my whole body was so much anaesthetic in the body, and then they'd have the knife, just a short knife, like a scalpel, and turn the knife, and pull it out, and then they'd all this
pus
coming out, pus, and like a volcano, basically, coming out, and then get a cigarette, hail the smoke, get a bit of paper, blow the smoke through the paper, put the paper with some sort of glue on top they had, and put the paper on top of the wound. And then they say, Tomas, pongo un palo en sus dientes. The worm just reacts to the smoke, and then it stops, so itchy, you want to touch it, but if you touch it, it goes back into the leg. And it came to the top, it lost its grip. And Will Smith said, okay, this is what we do. Hold the branch in your teeth. And this little worm would come out 23 times, putting the knife in and trying to get them out.
So did all of the people, all your captors, were they getting the worms too?
They didn't have too many worms. There was one guy had two or three, but the skin's much tougher. They loved our rich, sort of sweet skin, if you like, and very easy to get through. But the locals were such tough skin, not often did they get it. But when they did, it was so difficult even for them to get them out. Very difficult.
And with Paul, one had died inside and that infected his leg. He's really lucky to still have his leg.
He's really lucky, and they wanted to cut it off with a machete. They were dying to cut his leg off. Below the knee, Paul, or above the knee. We'll think about it tomorrow. And you could see under the shin bone, you could see light, the sunlight. The leg was rotting, and the worm had died inside, which caused the infection. Gangrene then came. And then he put a bandage over his leg. And then one morning I noticed his leg, it was moving. All the bandage was moving, and his leg was 4 or 5 times the size of what it normally would be. And all these maggots were coming out through the bandage. And they were eating the flesh, which was great. All
but
the
in
bad
fact,
flesh,
the maggots saved him.
The maggots saved him, and they came in and they managed to clean out the wound. So it was very lucky. But it was the walking that followed through the jungle.
But it was physically incredibly tough, wasn't it? Because you were carrying a rucksack, boots, another rucksack, and you would walk for, 6, 7, 8 hours at a time?
That's right, each day. And one time we walked 6 weeks every day with the Wellington boots they gave us, and very tough conditions, the mud, lodoso. I mean, it really was, every time you'd lift your Wellington boot out of the mud, you could feel the knee coming away from your groin, and these guys and ladies were so fit, and just they marched straight through it. Me and Paul were always getting stuck behind, or look at that orchid, Tomas.
So you must have thought a lot about what the outside world was doing, and I know you didn't find this out till later, obviously, but I mean, what were your parents thinking, yours and Paul's parents? What was going on back in England?
Well, as I say, we only knew all this after we'd got released, but we did have a hunch that this may happen, is that there was no communication with the outside world, if you like, El Darien, and the UK, there was nothing at all. So it was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. that Paul's dad flew to Panama to try and find him, quite close to where we were. They knew the region we were in from postcards we'd been sending about the wonderful trip we're looking forward to carry out in seeing the orchids and mountains. And my mum flew to Colombia, to Bogota, for 6 weeks to try and find us. But after they both returned in August of the year 2000, I had my vigil at home, my vigil at Lullingston, and Paul had his memorial service.
So were you both declared dead by an embassy? Or I mean, what's the process of that?
Yeah, we don't really know, Rosie, but after 6 months, no one knew what to do. There was no ransom, there was nothing. We just disappeared. And for people that have done that in the area over the years,
you just disappear.
So they just, my grandmum had decided that it was perhaps a caiman that ate me or something. And my dad had decided, and my sister had decided. But my mum was still determined. When she flew to Bogota, she had the complete coincidence of meeting Terry Waite, who was held hostage in Beirut 5 years, 3 years chained to a radiator. And he was very supportive, knew about the story, but knew the dangers of the area as well, but was very supportive to mum. And they were going to hold out till Christmas. And then as the new year approached in 2001, that would be it.
But she got a small plane and flew around, didn't she? And
she met people she'd never met before. She'd never been to South America before, and she flew out on her own for 8 weeks to Colombia, to Bogota. And she met all these amazing people who were just the British Embassy. Everybody was so helpful. Contacts, you may be able to help. And she had this a friend she met there who had a Cessna plane. Didn't go into the Darien, but quite close to the Darien. Turbo, Rio Sucio, Choco, all the areas just south of where we were. And mum's maternal instinct, she felt, they're both still in there.
Extraordinary. That's extraordinary. So, did you ever see any sign of drugs when you were there? I mean, what was...
There was no sign of drugs at all. Most evenings, they were very wary, very health conscious. And they said, you must, if you don't do this, we will kill you. You must wash your teeth with Colgate and mint flavoured. If you don't do that...
Did they supply you with the toothpaste?
Yes, they did. And you must brush your teeth in the evening and first thing in the morning, or I'm afraid we'll have to kill you. Okay.
Right. And they were very keen on you keeping clean and having baths.
You must be clean, Thomas, must be clean. So what we did, we used to steal all the soap, these blue bars of soap, and just wear them down excessively. We had baths that lasted for hours, and they couldn't work out where Tom and Paul were, and we'd come out of, we'd throw the soap away, and they loved the soap. It was like the holy grail for them of hygiene. And when all the soap was gone, it was costing them money, or it was costing somebody money or whatever, and we're just draining their resources as a way of dealing with it. The only time we saw any drugs, it came in a newspaper, and they opened up the newspaper, and there was some cocaine in there. It was a grey mix. And they said to me, what is this, Tom? You drug runner, you CIA, what's this? Paul, they've got this stuff over here. Oh, right, Tom. What are you going to say? I'm not quite sure what to say. Everybody was watching me, their eyes staring at me, seeing how I'd react. So I said, we get this in England. It's condensed milk powder. And they just stared at me. And they're like, Thomas.
Were they trying to say you were a drug runner at this point?
They were trying to do anything to match me with it. And my Spanish isn't brilliant, but every word I said had to be choreographed. I had to think exactly what I was saying, getting the tenses right, getting everything right, because a few words out of place or actions out of place could cost you your life and Paul's. So I was really wary of making too much of a joke of it and so on. But what else do you say? And we managed, because of the attitude that me and Paul had, the English gentleman thing of thanking them for everything. They just couldn't stand it any longer. And building the gardens,
You also got them playing chess with you, didn't you?
Yeah.
And card games.
Yeah, we played chess, we played card games. And quite a few of the evenings, they'd quite enjoy the card games. We'd sit in this camp, right in the cloud forest. Will Smith was there on one side with his friend and his two big guns. And me and Paul on this side, playing the game. And me and Paul were always winning. And Will Smith was 8-1 now. I mean, a heavy defeat for Will Smith. And Will Smith was just, Thomas? See. And we were changing the cards under the table to try and make him win. And we kept winning, he kept losing. And Paul said, if we die because of this card game, it's your... And Will Smith, the moustache was going like this, the eyes like this, and then he had this big gun, and eventually we managed to keep changing it, hours of playing it, and he did win about 25-16, I think, in the end.
Yeah. So when you get through, you're kidnapped in March, it's coming up to the end of the year, what suddenly changes?
The end was... It was extraordinary. You can't make it up.
Well, you can't make up most of this, so...
Right, Rosie, but certainly not this.
I know.
And December the 10th, 11:57 a.m. in the morning, I'll never forget it, of the year 2000, they all had these Casio watches on, so you could always tell what the time was. And they said they were really pissed off. They were really annoyed.
And you didn't know why?
We didn't know why. It's the first reaction we'd actually seen. They weren't directing it at us, but at themselves. They were shouting, they were screaming, throwing things around, machetes being thrown around. And two foot soldiers went up to the top of the hill. We were in Panama now. We'd come back from Colombia into Panama. We were near where we were kidnapped. We knew that. We were very
close.
Because
what, you recognised something?
We walked straight past it about a day or two earlier.
Right.
We knew something was happening. And were they going to kill us now? We didn't think so. Paul didn't. I was a little more unsure. And the two foot soldiers came back, and the camp, they went mad. And the commandante turned around to me, and he was so annoyed. And he got his foot, and he kicked the fire that was still burning. And the fire, some of the bits of fire stuck to his foot. He was on fire. He had this fire coming... Me and Paul didn't know what was going on. So he put the fire out of his foot and he just said, you're free to go. Oh, and here's all your stuff back. Soy, senor? They gave everything. Rosie, everything. They took 3/4 of a year earlier. Health passports, passports, driver's license, my orchid address book. And in my diary, I kept during captivity, La Señora de Lux. They gave everything back to us. $3,500 worth of unsigned traveller's checks they gave back to us, and explained they'd put them in Ziploc bags to keep the humidity out, to preserve the checks for you, Tom and Paul. They were going to kill us 10 minutes earlier. Was it a joke? As we turn our backs, they shoot us? We didn't know. Oh, here's your guide. He'll take you to the freedom. It was just instant.
Like that?
Just like that. Off we went down this path, and we crossed the only sign in the Darien, 14 years ago anyway, the only sign, a small piece of rock. Bienvenidos a Colombia y Los Catios National Park. And me and Paul said, this is in our Lonely Planet guidebook. This is the path we were going to take. Down we went into the hill. They said, Feliz Navidad, hasta luego, buen suerte en su vida. And then off they walked, the guides, they'd gone. Down the hill we went to this fork in the road, which they hadn't told us about. There's a big dead tree on the left-hand side. And me and Paul just, what route do we take? Decisive fork and clear roads, clear paths. Right. We just took the left. And within 5 or 6 minutes of taking this path, Tomás, Pablo, pendejo, usted, payaso, bobo. Will Smith. En serio. Will Smith just, you stayed in a bobo, Thomas. Sí, bobo, bobo. And they just, and we were kidnapped again.
No, you weren't. Good try.
Honestly. And he said, what are you doing? Oh, your boss said we could go. Okay, stay for some tangerines and cheese and turkey, pava. No, very kind, senor. We'd like to go home to see our families. No, honestly, stay tonight. It's very kind, but it's Christmas, and Tomás, usted está quedando con nosotros. Okay.
up to the camp, and there was this radio mast, some sort of radio mast, on the top of this hill. And Rosie, the vista was amazing. No trees, hardly around, grassland. First view we'd seen. Amazing view, the best view in three quarters of a year. And we stayed for a night with Will Smith. We had the most, we had cheese, tangerines.
Did he still have guns?
They were, and very edgy still. Right. But somehow Will Smith, he was smiling, he was quite relaxed. Lots of guns. There's about eight or nine of them in this small camp. And they said, tomorrow you go, Tom, and this is the route you take. With a wonderful guide. First thing in the morning, we got our rucksacks on, thanked them for everything, and Tom, please don't come back. Please stop talking about orchids. Honestly, they just couldn't take it, and they just said, go. And me and Paul was, we're going home. And I was like, still not sure. So down the hill we went with this guide who had one eye. And as we went into the forest again, the rain, the clouds came and the rain came mm-hmm. down. And it was so deafening, the rain. You couldn't hear yourself think or see where you're walking. It was so intense. And we got to this fork. Ah, senor.
No guide.
Gone. And me and Paul said, let's go left. That would have been fine in the summer.
And what happened when you went left?
But it was the winter and it was flooded. In Los Cactus National Park, and me and Paul for 5-6 days walking up here with the water.
You kept going for 5 or 6 days?
We just, including what happened in a minute, we just had to just get out of there. And after 3 or 4 days of doing this, getting lost, going around in circles, we were chipping with a machete the sides of the branches so we could see our route back. But we had a compass, but it's no good if you don't know the local paths, mm-hmm. which were all flooded. We'd taken the wrong route, and me, in my mind, had decided that the jungle was going to kill us. And all the food we'd stolen over those months and weeks to escape, we ate and used up. And we were sleeping in between two trees with these roots in between them and just sleeping on the water inside the tent. It was extraordinary. And Paul said that we're going to die here. Our feet were starting trench rot. Were starting to split and bits coming off and things. And Paul said, we're going back for directions.
So did you went back to Will Smith?
Back to Will Smith. And
hey.
Rosie, what can I say? They just stared at us. Yo no creo. Tomás está regresando. Igua. Pendejo. Pendísimo. Sí, señor. What's the problem? You turn right, Tom. I told you. You stay for more bird? Can we go home? Of course you can. And they turn around to us. Rosie, honestly, they paid us to go. They were giving us money. Just... $13,000. Tomás. Por favor, go, buy us it, just go.
And you went.
And we did, and the route, 2 days, it was extraordinary. We walked into the Los Cactus National Park, and we stumbled across these two guys who were park rangers. Mm-hmm. No guns, no combat gear, just two machetes. Ah, they weren't surprised to see us. Two white faces with rucksacks from England. Ah, happens all the time. It just was so, what are you doing? Oh, we're looking to go through the national park and then hopefully we can get to the freedom. You know it's very dangerous here, don't you?
And they didn't know who you were, did they?
No.
Very weird.
And recommend that you return back up the hill. And me and Paul just we can't do that. We have to go home. We've been kidnapped. Oh, you've been kidnapped for 9 months. Okay, well, you wait here, and we're going to do a special vole survey. There's a special vole in Los Catas with funny ears. We've got to do a survey. Had clipboards. We didn't know what to say. Okay, and as they turned their backs, me and Paul, down this path, the widest path we'd seen, Rosie, in 9 months, was about 6 foot wide, that they'd cut with their machetes, and to the National Park headquarters that we went. And it was all empty. There were no tourists there anymore, obviously. There was all just empty and run down. And 4 hours later, they returned, and a bit annoyed with us for not waiting after their vole survey, and said, oh, we phoned the embassy then. Really? How do you phone? CB radio. It doesn't work. Oh, yeah, it works. How they... We never understood this. They just phoned the Colombian embassy in Bogota. There was a couple of redirecting calls, mm-hmm. but they got to the embassy, and as the embassy member of some sort and the staff picked up the phone, we have Tom and Paul Winder and Tom Hartdyke here. No, you don't. I think we do, and they... But they died ages ago. You know, they... not. It was unbelievable. And so they had to put Paul on the phone. And the embassy stopped. Hello? It was just... And when we started to... That reaction and what followed in the next few days made us realise that people had just...
Given you up.
What else
so
do
when
you...
did you first speak to your mum?
First spoke to my mum within just a few hours of that. Within hours, this amazing Colombian Red Cross, this huge speedboat, flew down Rio Sucio and picked us up. Back we went to Turbo, and then private jet from Apartador to Bogota, and I found my mum from the embassy. Not many words, just you've been away for over 3 years, so it would be nice to... see you for Christmas.
Is that what she said? Wow.
Okay, Mum.
When
I get back, I imagine.
That must
quite
have been
right.
Really extraordinary.
And what was, Rosie, one thing in the embassy, the Colombian embassy or the British embassy in Bogota, it was extraordinary to be greeted by them and to sit down, Jeremy Thorpe and his lovely Uruguayan wife. She was amazing, and she sat us down. We watched the forecast, the UK forecast, a very wet winter we're having in 2000. Friendly people, English, on the TV, and we sat down and we ate. She was spoiling us, the ambassador's wife, some Ferrero Rocher. Me and Paul didn't know we didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to do. And you're getting on a British Airways flight tomorrow, Bogota, Caracas, and London. And we did, back for Christmas.
Extraordinary. Did you fall apart after you got back? Was it a hold yourself together and then...
Yeah, it was. I was just, my mind was so numb, really, from the whole experience. I suppose you might expect the stupidity of me and Paul for going there and then realising that we'd survived with these amazing people in the Darien, this experience. It was extraordinary. And I had 2 weeks of really being numbed and not knowing, just buzzing in my head. It was Christmas, I was trying to be cheerful and Santa Claus and presents. Mm-hmm. But it was quite difficult because for friends and family, they had to get an extra plate, extra set of food. They hadn't allocated for me being there for Christmas. I mean, it was that amazing. And it took me about 2 weeks to get over it. And then beginning of January 2001, let's build the garden at home, which I started in Colombia, and let's carry on the story in a different way.
So what have you learnt from having something like that happen to you at tender age of 23?
I think so many things I've learnt. I think within reason, obviously, living each day, you get just one chance on this planet, and friends at home, they come to me and say, I've had a terrible day, Tom. I missed my bus to work. I was 15 minutes late. Oh yeah, Colombia. Forget all the bus. Forget the bus. And you just realise different things, and you so appreciate what you've got. And my life is completely and utterly changed in every sense because of that amazing experience.
And Paul's life?
Paul as well. He's running a mountaineering shop in North London, which he's always wanted to do. a mountaineer at heart and still travels all over the world. I don't think perhaps come back to Colombia, but...
And how does it feel for you to be
back
here?
It feels great. And going to the Botanical Gardens, that was a... What a start. And coming to Cartagena, because the small little transistor radios that they had in the Darien, they have some news reports, mainly Apartador, but also Rio Sucio and from Cartagena, where you can go swimming, where you can get your chicken, where you can go to church on Sundays between 8 a.m. and 12 noon. The prices of the entry fee for the swimming pools. And the streets in Cartagena, I know some of the streets. I've never been here before. I've never looked at a map of Cartagena, but from the descriptions on the radio of where things are in Cartagena and indeed Apartador, it's really special. And
well,
everyone's so brilliant.
We'll get you out into the sunlight. Paul and I have literally got off the plane at 9:55, so you haven't seen anything of Cartagena, but you're going to be able to enjoy it. Now, we've got some time for questions.
How do you put it on, Rosie?
Okay.
En español. Bueno, mire. Yo no sé si está bien fuera de contexto de lo que voy a preguntar, pero sé que estuviste en una región que creo que ninguno de los que estamos aquí la conoce. Temeroso y todo. Como sabemos.
Lo siento.
You can take this one.
Okay. Testing, 1, 2, we can hear. Yep. Yep.
You okay? Okay.
Great, yeah,
okay.
Que esta pregunta que voy a hacer no sé si está fuera de contexto. Sin embargo, esa región que usted conoció, que es tan importante para el mundo y que creo que lo que vivimos, que estamos aquí, no la conocemos, creo que ninguno la conoce. La pregunta que quiero hacer es, la carretera panamericana que está interrumpida en ese sitio, ¿sí será necesario que dañemos la selva esa para poder tener la continuidad de carretera? ¿Sí será necesario para el mundo? ¿O mejor utilizamos los otros medios que siempre han habido, barcos, aviones, no sé? Gracias.
It's a great question, a great question. In a strange way, because of the politics of the Darien Gap, I'm not sure what it's like now, but because of the politics of the Darien Gap over the years, it's one of the most pristine rainforests on the planet. There are no roads, the rivers there are hardly accommodate a small boat. And because of some of the problems there, it's one of the best preserved areas in the world. And in a strange way, it's an amazing thing. Because there were plans in the 1950s to build a road through it, and it was the swamps of the area that were really challenging. And the spread of foot and mouth from parts of South America to North America. They wanted to keep a big green hedge in parts of Mexico, I read. And since 1950s, 60s, 70s, the politics of the area has prevented a road. And it probably always will be the only break in the Pan-American Highway. And in many ways, that's not a bad thing.
Hi. Tom, hi. This is actually not a question. If there is anything that proves that what it doesn't kill us, it makes us stronger, is you. And I think all of us agree that you are not just a wonderful person, you're a truly wonderful person. And from my Colombian heart, and I'm sure all of us here would like to say huge, huge apologies for what you have been through.
Thank you very much.
And a massive, huge, enormous thank you for coming back, and even bigger for not losing your faith in Colombia. Thank you so much. We love you, mate.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi. Hi. Hey. Hello. Hey, how are you? I am here. Besides orchids, what else caught your attention regarding the plants? Did you take any notes? And what about big animals around?
I'll try to answer this as politely as possible about the animals. The Darien is extraordinary. Yes, the orchids were fantastic, but the bromeliads, the air plants, the pine trees, the palm trees, extraordinary. Ceiba as well, a fantastic range of plants. The animal life, we saw jaguars, we saw extraordinary things. These huge black cats that they tried to shoot the cats with the guns, but the cat was too fast. Extraordinary things that even animals that probably aren't even named yet, but a lot of the wildlife.
You ate it.
Did eat quite a bit of the wildlife. It was the only thing we had to eat, and sometimes when we were very stressed, or our captors were stressed high up, very isolated in the mountains, we did eat quite a few things, armadillos, monkeys, spiders, parrots.
You ate spiders?
Spiders.
You can't get much nutrition out of a spider.
The legs are quite crunchy, and when they go down, the hairs, como bigotes. I shouldn't have said that, but but we saw a lot of wildlife. It was an extraordinary place, and our lucky butterfly was this extraordinary, amazing blue butterfly. And whenever we were having a bad day, it would fly past. And thank you.
Tom, well, bouncing back on my friend's comment right now, I would also like to thank you very much for that story. It's truly amazing to hear such a story of such thing that's usually quite tragic, you know, all the stories of people being held hostage, and some of them are very famous, and Ingrid Betancourt and John Pinchao are all terrible, terrible stories, and you read those books and it's heart-wrenching, really. But on the contrary, you seem to tell it with such, you know, I mean, you managed to make it funny. I mean, you made us laugh several times with that story. I'd like to know how do you do that? You know, how were you able to keep that distance and that sort of very British phlegm of, you know, keeping it, just taking it easy and having a good time whilst you were there? Or was it something that you managed to digest and tell it in this way now? How did you do that? Because I think there's a lot to learn from this attitude. Thank you.
I've actually today in some ways dumbed it down. It's during the time that we did it, we invented it almost. We were being deliberately, as a tactic, for saying thank you for everything. Thank you so much for the howler monkey. It was the hair, it got stuck a bit, and the rubber fingers were rubbery in our teeth when we ate it. But thank you so much for the monkey. And they just stopped thanking us. Thank you. Just stop. And it was just a way of making it quite comical in some ways. There were some times when it was the most funniest experience ever. Some extraordinary days of it was just, and you forgot where you were, building these gardens during captivity as a way of dealing with the situation that I was in, as I've explained. I just transported myself elsewhere. It was just extraordinary. It drove them mad. It was a way of dealing with it, but it was just absolutely extraordinary. And then suddenly they turn around to you and say, Paul, he's smoking a cigarette, and Peli Rojo? Pelirojo, que fuerte, que fuerte, ey. And he was smoking away, Paul, this, and they'd go, tell Paul not to smoke. They gave him the cigarette to smoke, but tell Paul, one of them said, not to smoke. Okay, it's bad for the lungs, bad for the throat. And he was tapping me on the shoulder, this guy, with this M16 gun. And what's worse? Don't know, but... And we just were laughing out loud, and they didn't know what to do. It was extraordinary. But that's why I'm alive, why we both survive, I think.
Okay, we have time for one more. Okay, thank you.
So, is there a book that you wrote about your experience? And is this still in print? And have you been approached at all about making a movie about this? or about talking to other people about your experiences, so in the event they go to areas that might be unsafe, they know how to use the British charm to be safe and alive?
Well, I do a lot of talks at home, mainly to horticultural societies, cactus groups, orchid groups, and so on. And it just adds a little extra to the talk.
Yeah. And half. Yeah.
And I have got some books that me and Paul wrote. I could only bring a few on the plane.
We're going they will be outside. So after.
Called The Cloud Garden, that me and Paul wrote about our experiences.
And if you can't get it today, you can get it online. You've got, what, about 8 copies left?
Yes, I've got about 12 or
12,
so.
12, all right.
12. And about the movie, occasionally people ring up, mainly comedians in Britain. You may have heard of French and Saunders. Maybe French and Saunders, but they rang up and said, can you and Paul come to our studios? And they just, what I was just saying, the gentleman here, they just, Monty Python, Flying Circus, if you're familiar with that, and John Cleese will come out, and perhaps Will Smith will play Will Smith. Because it has that funny element, and because of the funny element, we survived the experience. They didn't know what to do. But there are occasionally people do ring up about it and ask, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you all for being such a fantastic audience, and thank you, Tom.